The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We're following some fun and festivities last night, the graduation ball here at Edstone. We had a beautiful evening outside, actually. Had our fine meal outside, saw some slide presentations inside, and had some dancing inside and outside. So a wonderful night here at beautiful Edstone. These programs, by the way, we're now... I guess as of yesterday, we're trying to put at least the audio up. We're still aiming to show the video on YouTube from time to time, even though we haven't done that in a while. But we're now trying to make the audio available on YouTube and maybe Twitter, something else. I don't know. Richard's in there in the booth now with Sam. So our staff here, as far as the live program is concerned, has increased by 33%, or no, that'd be 50%, I guess. So we've got three here instead of just the two of us, and hopefully because of this, we're reaching a bigger audience, and we'll certainly update you in the days to come about some of those figures. On today's show, we're going to be looking at the investigation into the investigators. We talked some on that yesterday. There's another article I'd like to get into in the Washington Post on this new prosecutor that's been appointed by the Attorney General, William Barr. So we'll come to that here in just a moment. Also, later on in the show, we'll finish our study on the War of the Wills. Yesterday, we concluded with those passages, Colossians 2 and Romans 7. And then a powerful quote from Mr. Armstrong. We'll lead in with that, and then, as I say, put the finishing touches on that study. To begin with, I'd like to just follow up a little bit more on the trade war with China. The president, as I said yesterday, and even played for you yesterday, he's laid out his strategy, and it's pretty clear and straightforward. How that this the U.S. is in a pretty strong position, and that if there are tariffs on both sides, it's going to hurt China more than it will hurt the United States, as he often does when he's on his way out with the helicopter or wherever there at the White House. He always stops and talks to all of the reporters, takes their questions, and just answers right off the top of his head. He definitely does give them access. You would think the press would be more appreciative of that. The fact that he's available, that he's giving interviews regularly, that he calls into shows even, to tell people, and of course he's tweeting constantly, to tell the American people, here's what I'm doing, here's what the United States is up to, here's our position on China. To lead in with that yesterday outside the White House, he talked about, again, the strength of the U.S. economy. This is clip one.
I think we probably have the greatest economy that we've ever had. Employment numbers came out, as you know. They're record levels in almost every category. African American, the best in history. You take a look. Hispanic American, the best in history. Yesterday, Asian American numbers came in. They are the lowest in history, the history of our country. Women, I think it's 61 years, and soon that'll be historic, too. So that we are doing, and as far as employment numbers, we have the most people working today in the United States that we've ever had before, almost 160 million people. So it's really good.
It's really good, he says. So this, in the short run, this is what China's going up against. And again, I'll refer you to yesterday's show if you'd like to get just a little bit more commentary on these tariffs and on the trade war. Ultimately, it's not going to work out well for the United States, but to just make the point that I made yesterday briefly, China's going to need some help. And speaking of China, he talked in front of those reporters about the deal that they had in place but that China walked away from. This is clip two.
But we made a deal with China. It was a deal that was a very good deal. It had to be a good deal. Otherwise, we're not making it because we've been down so low in trade. And other presidents should have done this a long time ago. We can't just make a good deal. And I told that to President Xi. But we had a deal that was very close, and then they broke it. They really did. I mean, more than renegotiate, they really broke it. So we can't have that happen.
They broke the deal. They walked away. And they didn't want to renegotiate. They just broke the deal, he says. And we can't let that happen. And then listen to what he said about what has typically been the case in over the course of many presidencies, just how that other nations have taken advantage of the United States. This is clip three.
We're having a little squabble with China because we've been treated very unfairly for many, many decades, for actually a long time. And it should have been handled a long time ago, and it wasn't, and we'll handle it now. I think it's going to turn out extremely well. We're in a very strong position. We are the piggy bank that everybody likes to take advantage of or take from, and we can't let that happen anymore.
When have you heard a president take that position? Obama didn't. George W. Bush, Clinton. He's, as I said yesterday, he's standing up to China. And he said very simply, and this, of course, is more from the nationalist, populist playbook, I guess. But he said that President Xi, he's got a good relationship with him. He likes him. He thinks he's a good man for the most part, but that he's for China and I'm for the USA. America first, as he said all through the campaign. And I played those clips yesterday going back to the late 1980s. This has been something that he's been out there. He's been out there preaching way back when he was in his 50s as a businessman, as a real estate mogul. And now he's in the office of president, and he's following through on yet another campaign promise that he made back in 2015 and 2016. So we'll see how it plays out in the short run. It does look like the U.S. is in a pretty strong position just in looking at the short run. Yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he was in Russia sitting alongside his Russian counterpart, the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. And they were both sitting at the same table, and Lavrov spoke up and said that he wanted the United States to stop interfering with Russian domestic policy, if you can believe it. And I think it was all Pompeo could do not to start cracking up. But he sat there and listened to the interpreter, and she went on for a time telling him and the American delegation that Russia thinks that America should stop meddling. And then this is what the Secretary of State said in response. Clip four.
You can see we have some disagreements on this issue. I promise not to go back to history from the early 30s. But I made clear for Mr. Lavrov, as we've made clear for the past months, that interference in American elections is unacceptable. If the Russians were to engage in that in 2020, it would put our relationship in an even worse place than it has been, and encourage them not to do that, that we would not tolerate that. We've said this not only about the Russians, but about other countries as well. Our elections are important and sacred, and they must be kept free and fair.
That's the Secretary of State yesterday in Russia, right alongside the Russian foreign minister, saying that the U.S. elections are important and sacred, and that the U.S. would not tolerate Russian interference. Now, again, I don't recall the previous administration confronting Putin's Russia this directly. You remember the reset button. You remember President Obama promising Vladimir Putin more flexibility. He told Medvedev to, hey, pass along this message. I'll have more flexibility if I can just get reelected. Here's the United States. Now, finally, I've told you before about what the U.S. was not doing in the lead up to the 2016 election, even when there were warnings coming from mostly Republicans, Devin Nunes, to name just one, warning back in 2014 about Russian interference. And then all the warnings in the summer of 2016. And then Barack Obama saying, well, there's nothing. It's nothing serious. They've done this, you know, routinely. And then only after Donald Trump wins the election, then you have John Brennan's CIA coming out and saying, hey, Russia not only interfered, they did it in a spectacular way, and they did it to help Donald Trump. And then you have all that you've seen these past couple of years, spying on the Trump campaign, really setting up Trump officials or anyone connected to Trump, setting them up and trapping them. We'll talk more on that in just a second. Only now, only in the last few weeks, only since the beginning of this year, are the tables beginning to turn. And now the investigators are looking into how all of this got started. And the president is quite happy that finally, they can look into how the investigation into Russia and meddling and collusion and conspiracy and all of that, how that got started in the first place. In front of those reporters outside the White House yesterday, this is what the president said about the new attorney general and his approach. Clip 5.
They want to look at how that whole hoax got started. It was a hoax. And even Mueller, not a friend of mine, even Bob Mueller came out, no collusion. And he had 18 people that didn't like Donald Trump. They were Hillary Clinton fans. They contributed, many of them, to Hillary Clinton. They came out. It was the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the people of this country. And you know what? I am so proud of our attorney general that he is looking into it. I think it's great.
The greatest hoax in the history of politics in the United States. And he's happy to see the attorney general now looking into it. And when you look at what's happening, even as recently as this week, it's looking like he's about to blow the lid off this hoax and expose it. If you go back to his testimony, William Barr, this is an exchange he had with Lindsey Graham back at the first part of this month, May 1st. Listen to how he responded to all of Graham's concerns about the FISA process and the investigation, how it started in the first place. This is clip 12.
Do you share my concerns about the FISA warrant process?
Yes.
Do you share my concerns about the counterintelligence investigation, how it was opened and why it was opened?
Yes.
Do you share my concerns that the professional lack of professionalism in the Clinton email investigation is something we should all look at?
Yes.
Do you expect to change your mind about the bottom line conclusions of the Mueller report?
No.
Do you know Bob Mueller?
Yes.
Do you trust him?
Yes.
How long have you known him?
30 years, roughly.
You think he had the time he needed?
Yes.
You think he had the money he needed?
Yes.
You think he had the resources he needed?
Yes.
Do you think he did a thorough job?
Yes, and I think he feels he did a thorough job and had adequate evidence to make the calls.
Do you think the president's campaign in 2016 was thoroughly looked at in terms of whether or not they colluded with the Russians?
Yes.
And the answer is no, according to Bob Mueller.
That's right.
He couldn't decide about obstruction. You did. Is that correct?
That's right.
You feel good about your decision?
Absolutely.
Here he is saying yes, 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 no, absolutely. Absolutely, I feel comfortable with my decision. No obstruction. Did Mueller do a thorough enough investigation? He certainly did. There was at one point when he was being asked that he had a big smile on his face. Yes, he definitely had the resources. 30-some million dollars. And all these angry Democrats helping him. And if he gets to the end of that process and determines there's no collusion, that was supposedly the underlying crime. And there was no collusion. All of this spying, all of these informants, all of the FISA applications because of the Steele dossier. Four different applications signed by the Attorney General at the time, Loretta Lynch. She was on the plane with Bill Clinton in the summer of 2016. All of this needs to be looked into. Do you agree? Well, yes, I do. Do you have the same concerns I share? I sure do. This is the highest law enforcement official in the United States. The tables have definitely turned. And Barr's pick, as we learned, I think it was Monday night, his pick to investigate into this is John Durham, this prosecutor that we're now learning a little bit more about. He's kept a fairly low profile, even though he's worked on some higher profile cases. But now he's out there. His name is out there. And now come the reports explaining who he is, what he thinks, what he's been involved in the past. This article from the Washington Post, no friend of President Trump, that's for sure. But it says here in 1998, so this goes back 20 years or so, U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Donald Stern needed someone to look into allegations that the FBI had been protecting mob leaders in Boston. One of them was Irish mob boss James Whitey Bulger. This was a big case involving potential misdeeds by high-ranking federal law enforcement agents, and Stern knew who he wanted. We didn't go to Washington with a list. Stern told the AP, we went to Washington and said, we want John Durham to do this. We want John Durham to investigate into this. This is the one that William Barr just picked. Evidently, he's been on it now for a month or two, investigating the investigators. But back in 1998, when the FBI was covering for mob leaders in Boston, protecting mob leaders, who did they call to investigate into this? That would be John Durham. It says the new special prosecutor's work would lead to the overturning of four 1968 murder convictions after he unearthed secret documents revealing an FBI informant had framed the men. These were two mob boss outfits that were fighting against one another. And the one side, they went to the FBI as informants. These were some evil actors through and through. And the FBI took the side of one over the other, and they got it wrong. And then they didn't want to admit their mistake. Now, this went back decades, of course, and was finally revealed then in 1998 or at the turn of the century. But it's a fascinating look back at these individuals who were framed, basically. And then it was John Durham who went back and corrected the wrong, even though it made the FBI look pretty bad. That's some interesting history, I'd say, given what we've seen the last couple of years. The Washington Post says 2 decades later, Durham is again being called upon to investigate allegations of FBI wrongdoing, this time when it comes to surveillance of members of the 2016 Trump campaign. And it goes and talks about some of the things that Republicans have been trying to draw attention to for the last couple of years. It says Durham comes to the job with what is, by almost all accounts, a sterling decades-long career as a prosecutor. It's very similar to William Barr. A sterling decades-long career as a prosecutor. And he's been brought along by Democrats and Republicans alike because he's upheld the law. It says, though he was nominated to his current post by the U.S. As the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut by President Trump, he has been selected by both Republican and Democrat administrations to conduct high-profile investigations involving alleged wrongdoing by the federal government. And then it gives some examples of that. working with George W. Bush, working with Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. It says here, through it all, Durham has maintained a remarkably low profile, seldom speaking outside of a courtroom. It says a little bit later, I think that he proved that he wasn't there simply to whitewash the FBI misconduct that's following his investigation in 1998. He wasn't there to just whitewash the conduct and say, well, this is the FBI, and we don't want to make the FBI look bad. Instead, he said or thought, if there's misconduct, if someone was illegally framed, then we've got to go back and make it right. It says, if it's the right call, he's going to make it, no matter who it hurts or helps. That's quoting from someone that's familiar with him or his work. If it's the right call, he's going to make it. This is John Durham. No matter who it hurts or helps. And so you have a president now, as I've brought out before. He's standing up to this evil. He's exposing a great evil. And now he's got a law enforcement official in William Barr, who's doing the same thing. And now Barr has appointed this prosecutor, John Durham. Going back to some of that history from 1998 through to 2000, 2001, it says, in 2001, then FBI Director Louis Freeh called the scandal, this is the Whitey Bulger scandal, a very sad chapter in the history of the agency. A congressional committee in 2003 issued a scathing report labeling it one of the greatest failures in the history of federal law enforcement. And you can thank John Durham largely for exposing it. It says the matter even tangentially involved Robert Mueller III. He was an assistant U.S. attorney in Boston in the 1980s, even serving as acting U.S. attorney when Bulger was informing. Mueller succeeded Freeh as FBI director in 2001 when the scandal was still coming to light. It says, while reforms were instituted governing the use of informants, Mueller emphasized, I think the public should recognize that what happened happened years ago. So he tried to downplay it, Mueller. He didn't want the FBI to come out looking very bad. He later became the FBI director. But Durham said, well, if there was wrongdoing, it needs to be exposed. This was a dark chapter for the FBI, going back to that case from 1968. Then it's exposed in 1998. The last part of this article, it says, the Mueller report states that the Russia investigation was initially launched based upon Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos telling a foreign official that Russia had dirt on Trump's 2016 opponent, Hillary Clinton. And then it talks about the Republicans crying foul over the Steele dossier and so on, spying on Carter Page, the FISA warrants. The article says, because of his limited public comments, it's difficult to ascertain much about Durham's prosecutorial philosophy when it comes to public corruption. In 2001, he urged reporters to talk to other people involved in the Boston mob case, not him. So he's like I say, he's kept a fairly low profile. But he also said in 2002, nobody in this country is above the law, an FBI agent or otherwise, and ultimately, the ends do not justify the means. Ultimately, you see, the law must be upheld. You've got to uphold the law, or the whole system breaks down. Everything will fall apart. That's from a comment he made in 2002. The article concludes saying, but in 2018, he gave a rare speech at the University of St. Joseph. In the process of recounting the Boston mob case, he spoke to the pitfalls of the two-edged sword of informants. Listen to this. This is something he said last year. John Durham, the one now looking into, the one investigating the investigators last year, He said about the two-edged sword of informants, he said the damage that can be done when law enforcement or prosecutors misuse these tools is difficult to overstate. And then he said, and we unfortunately have seen it in some recent instances, a little bit of insight into this new prosecutor. There's a new law enforcement official that's now looking into all of the nefarious activity going on in 2016. And even before that, we're beginning to find out slowly but surely. It mentioned in one of those paragraphs I just paraphrased, George Papadopoulos, the whole investigation was launched based on discussions that he had. He told the Australian official Alexander Downer about the fact that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton. And then that, we're told, that's why the FBI had to look into this. That's why they had to investigate this. That's why they did all the spying. That's why all the surveillance. Papadopoulos, he's been making the rounds, and it's easy to dismiss him because, well, he was just a low-level campaign aide, but he's now written his book. I forget the name of it, but we're going to have to get a copy of that one too, I guess, because the more and more you look into his involvement in the Trump campaign and the investigation or the spying on him, and then now the more you hear his story, Deep State Target, that's the name of it, his new book. But listening to his story, it's exposing the hoax. It's exposing what went on behind the scenes with the Comey-led FBI and even the Mueller investigation as well. He was on with Mark Stein recently, who commentates on Fox News. And this is, again, Stein asked him about the fact that it's easier for the United States to spy on Americans outside of America because you can get the help of other agencies, international agencies. You can get the allies of the United States, like the British, like the Australians, to help. And that's why looking into Papadopoulos' story is a fascinating look at this world that you otherwise would not see. But now it's being exposed. This is what Papadopoulos said to Mark Stein in an interview just recently, clip 10.
I mentioned because I was in London, it was much easier to create this spying operation against me. And when I met Mifsud, actually, for the first time after this organization encouraged me to go to Rome, I met Mifsud, just to be clear, at a school named Link Campus,
right,
which is a CIA FBI training ground,
yeah,
which David Ignatius of the Washington Post has written extensively about, and he himself attended a CIA symposium at this university in 2004. So a lot of the characters involved in Spygate actually were affiliated with Link Campus, including Michael Gaeta, who is currently under investigation by Horowitz. Mm. He was the FBI's liaison in Rome. Steele, Mifsud, London Center for International Law Practice, FBI, CIA, Italian Intelligence, MI6. They all were affiliated at this campus, and George Papadopoulos was just encouraged to go to this school.
So he's there with Mark Stein explaining how he came into contact with Joseph Mifsud and this Link Campus University in Rome, in Italy, and all the connections that campus had with these international, these Western intel agencies. Now, just a few weeks ago, I think it's May the 3rd, Devin Nunes, he sends this letter to Secretary of State Pompeo, and then Directors Haspel, Nakasone, and Ray at the FBI. This is following the release of the Mueller report, where Mueller made Joseph Mifsud out to be, you know, this individual that had all these connections with Russia. with Russians. And so then it was conversations with Mifsud that then got to Alexander Downer that supposedly got the investigation off and running. And Papadopoulos said in that interview that this Link Campus University, how did he put it? It was it's a CIA FBI training ground. Now, Nunez, in his letter, he's writing these directors. He's writing the Secretary of State. He's writing the director of the FBI saying, look, Bob Mueller said that Mifsud had just all these Russian connections. I'll just quote from the Nunez letter. This is from May 3rd. He said on Thursday, April 18th, the Department of Justice publicly released the special counsel Robert Mueller's report. And then further on, it says the report includes numerous details on Mifsud, who told George Papadopoulos that the Russian government had dirt on Hillary Clinton, comprising thousands of emails. Papadopoulos later related this information to others, which served as the official pretext for the FBI to open the investigation. Nunez says the special counsel's report portrays Mifsud as having deep ties to Russia, detailing his trips to Moscow and extensive contacts with Russian officials, including a one-time employee of the IRA, the Russian organization that conducted social media attacks on the 2016 U.S. elections. So this was a massive point, a big point made in the first part of the Mueller report. The fact that you had this IRA organization, they were trying to meddle in the U.S. elections and so on. And the special counsel's report basically says Mifsud had, he was a one-time employee of that organization. He's a Russian, basically. Well, he's the Maltese academic, and he was based in the London area. But still, the point of Nunez's letter is that he's got all these connections with Russia. And that's how Papadopoulos was reeled into it. And that served as the pretext. But listen to this. This is from the Nunez letter. It says, the special counsel's report explains that Papadopoulos met Mifsud at Link Campus University, which the report, you just heard what Papadopoulos said about Link Campus. It says here in this letter, this Nunez letter, which the report, that would be the Mueller report, describes simply as a for-profit institution headed by a former Italian government official. And that's all that it says. This is crazy. The Mueller report. That's all that it, $30 million, all of these investigators, all of these people out to get Donald Trump. And in the end, they say, well, we can't prove any collusion. But you can see how there's still evidence of a cover-up here. Why wouldn't they say more about Link, this Link campus? It cites the description to an article in The Guardian. This is the Mueller report. Remember last week I told you about all the quotes from Fox News or CNN, The Guardian. This is the $30 million investigation, just citing these news sources. And Nunez says, look, they quote from The Guardian to say that it was just simply a for-profit institution headed by a former Italian government official. No elaboration there. And then Nunez goes back and quotes from the same Guardian article that says one Rome-based professor claimed Link Campus had a reputation for being closely connected to some elements within the Italian intelligence services. So this is like the Italian CIA, the Italian FBI. This Link campus, Papadopoulos takes it a step further and says, this is actually a CIA FBI training ground, which brings up a couple of questions. If that's the case, was this Mifsud actually some kind of a Russian agent? Or was he working with some Western intel agency? And if it was a Western intel agency, or if it wasn't a Western intel agency, then there's this Russian that has all, like Nunez brings out in his memo, that has all these Western intelligence agencies compromised. Let me just give you the conclusion. I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but I want you to, this is just from the Nunez letter from a couple weeks ago, and this is his concluding point, if Mifsud has extensive suspicious contacts among Russian officials as portrayed in the special counsel's report, then an incredibly wide range of Western institutions and individuals may have been compromised by him, including our own State Department. Alternatively, if Mifsud is not in fact a counterintelligence threat, then that would cast doubt on the special counsel's fundamental depiction of him and his activities and raise questions about the veracity of the special counsel's statements and affirmations. We just want to get to the truth here. What are the facts? Who is this Mifsud? Why is he so mysterious? Why did he disappear? You've got Mifsud, you've got Stefan Halper, you've got Isra Turk, the blonde undercover FBI agent trying to seduce Papadopoulos. You've got all the spying on Carter Page, the FISA warrants. You've got the Australian official, Alexander Downer. That's a lot easier to spy on someone, an American citizen, if it happens abroad. And it was happening. And this is just one example. How many more are there? That's what Papadopoulos asks in some of these interviews. Listen first, though, to what he said. This is the conclusion, or at least the second clip that I have from that Mark Stein exchange, clip 11.
And what the new information is that came out recently about Mifsud and my introduction to him are two very fascinating points. The first is that Vincenzo Scotti, the former Italian foreign minister, who was also a rector at this university, he introduced me to Mifsud. So right away you could understand that this was no ordinary passing off to somebody.
Yeah.
And the second is that Mifsud's lawyer last week in front of the Italian media stated that Mifsud was forced to introduce George Papadopoulos to imaginary Russians and create this bizarre scenario that we found ourselves in moving forward. So from the beginning, it looks like this was an entrapment operation designed and probably coordinated by either British intelligence or the FBI using the Italians initially.
The Italians, the British, the FBI, CIA. And then you have Australia reeled into this as well because of Alexander Downer. And you would think if anyone writes a book and says that Donald Trump is mentally unstable, he's going to be interviewed on every single talk show. You would think Papadopoulos is making the rounds with Fox News and Mark Stein, and that's about it. Why isn't he being interviewed right across the board on all media platforms and outlets? Given what he's saying, what he just said there, these are serious, serious charges. What about this Link campus? What about the Italian intelligence agencies or British intelligence agencies? What about the FBI? What about the CIA? He said on Fox News, this was, I think, going back a week ago, and it's content that you can pull out from Papadopoulos' book, evidently. But he talks about an incident in 2017 where someone left him with a pile of cash, and then it led later to his arrest, Papadopoulos' arrest, at Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. This is a longer exchange with the host on Fox News. But listen to this, clip 13.
Fast forward to 2017, when someone dropped $10,000 in cash in your lap. What happened?
This element that you just raised, Maria, is probably going to actually provide evidence that I was part of an entrapment operation by Mueller's team, not even the politicized FBI under Comey. In the summer of 2017, I was reached out to once again by another person who wanted to do business with me. And I was on vacation with my then-girlfriend, now wife, in Mykonos, in Greece. And he comes to me and he says, why don't you come to Israel with me and let's talk about working together. I go to Israel with him and he drops $10,000 in my lap in a room in Tel Aviv. And I don't understand what's happening. I'm very disturbed by the event. I fly to Athens the next day. I give the money to my lawyers. And this person tells me he doesn't want his money back. So immediately I thought there was something wrong.
Why did he give you the money, though, George? You accepted the money. What was the money for?
Well, we were talking about working on some sort of political consulting venture, like a lot of these people were reaching out to me after I left the transition team. And once I saw cash, I was in a foreign country. I took it. I gave it to my lawyer because I thought there was something illegal about it. I get to Dulles Airport
and
I have
7
FBI agents.
You get on a plane to go back to Washington. What happens when you land? Now, right now, you gave the money to your lawyer, so you don't have the money. But perhaps they assumed you did keep the money. So you're on a plane. You go to Dulles. What happens when you land in Washington?
Yeah, so as the money, which is currently in Athens right now with my lawyer, and I actually want Congress, Barr, Horowitz, and Hoover to actually review the bills because I still have the bills, and I think they're marked. I get to Dulles, and I have FBI agents scrambling. They don't even know why they're arresting me. I have no arrest warrant waiting for me. I'm not told why I'm being arrested. And later I find out from a report that came out a couple days ago that Andrew Weissmann and Mueller's team was actually in touch with officials in Cyprus, and I think the legal attaché over there, to discuss both Paul Manafort and myself, because I actually was in Cyprus over that summer in 2017. So something very insidious was going on here. I think these bills that are still in Athens right now must be examined by the investigators, because I think they're marked and they're going to go all the way back to the DOJ under the previous FBI under Comey, and even the Mueller team. And if the Mueller team is going around and trapping campaign associates and Trump associates the way they did to me, I'm sure it wasn't just me that they did it to, and it's going to open up a massive can of worms, and I think we need to get to the bottom of exactly not only how did this story start, but why were they entrapping us moving forward?
So those are some serious charges. It's laid out in his book, and now he's getting the message out. Why was he being contacted? He was 27, 28 years old at the time. A low-level official on the Trump campaign. Before that, he was with Ben Carson. Then he shifts over to Donald Trump, and as soon as he does that, hey, I've got someone you need to meet in Rome. And then Mifsud, hey, I've got someone you need to meet over here. And then people are throwing cash in his lap. He doesn't have all the answers, and neither do we. But you've got John Durham. You've got John Durham, who believes in upholding the law, and he's working for William Barr, the new attorney general, as of just a few months ago. And you have Donald Trump, the president of the United States, who considers it his crowning achievement to expose this hoax, to expose its evil origin. And we're beginning to see that happen. Listen to what attorney Joe DeGeneva, he said last night on Fox. This is clip 9.
Durham's appointment means that the already occurred meetings between the attorney general, the CIA director, and the director of national intelligence have now focused on a laser that the core of this conspiracy began with John Brennan and ends with John Brennan in London and D.C., and the Democratic National Committee. This is very serious business. And for the first time, I now believe that some of these guys are going to go to prison.
That's Joe DeGeneva last night on Fox. The only thing I would disagree with there is that the core of this evil, the core of this investigation, it starts not with John Brennan. He's certainly a main player. It starts with Barack Obama. It's the Antiochus administration. It's Barack Obama. It's Loretta Lynch. It's John Brennan. It's James Clapper, Jim Comey. They were all involved. But it was guided and directed from the top. And we'll see, I guess, how much of that gets exposed before it's all said and done. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll conclude our study on submitting to God's will, thy will be done. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
At the end of yesterday's program, we talked about the way of the Christian, how that it's a constant battle for true Christians to strive against sin, to turn to God, and to seek Him earnestly in prayer for power, for strength, and then to put in the diligence, the diligent Bible study, so that we can understand the will of God, as I've covered before, Ephesians 5:17. This is the way. And you're constantly making progress if you're a true Christian, growing in character, getting closer to God. There may be the occasional setback or stumble, but a true Christian always gets up and continues going forward. In Ephesians 2, verse 8, it says, "For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast." Many have actually misinterpreted this passage to just say, no works at all, nothing. Just believe. Just believe on Christ. Grace here and faith both. They're both gifts from God. And it is not of human works, as verse 9 brings out. We can't drag ourselves or pull ourselves into the kingdom of God. But verse 10, though, you have to keep reading, as I often tell my epistle students, if there's any confusion or misinterpretation, then just keep reading on and see the context. Understand the beginning verses and the verses after the verse in question. Verse 10 says, "For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God has before ordained that we should walk in them." So we were created to be instruments of God's workmanship. Mr. Armstrong said back in 1983, "Don't forget that we are a work in God's hands. His creation is going on in us. But we have our part in it," he said. "And yet the character that is to come into us comes from God." Don't forget, he said. Don't forget that we're God's workmanship, that we're a work in God's hands. He's reproducing Himself. He's recreating His character, His nature. And so our part, as 1 Peter 5 says, we've got to humble ourselves and come under the mighty hand of God. There's a mighty work being done if God is working in your life, shaping and molding you into something that would resemble Him. In Romans 9, staying in Paul's writings here, verse 20, it says, "Nay, but, O man, who are you that reply against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, 'Why have you made me thus?'" God calls us the thing here. Who are we to turn around and to look at the one who's forming and fashioning us into a God being? Who are we to question God, to second guess God, the creator, the master potter. Verse 21 says, has not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? We are literally made from clay. We come from the dust of the earth, human beings. And God is the master potter, as it says here in Romans 9. Isaiah said the same thing in chapter 64. God is a creator. He's working on a masterpiece. He's sculpting us individually. And he has to do it his way. There's no other way. We can't tell him how to do it. We have to submit to his will. We have to have faith that he knows what's best for us. God doesn't want us there sitting in judgment of him. He's God. He's our maker. He brought this magnificent physical creation into existence. He's the one that recreated the surface of the earth so that it could support physical life. You look at that and you look at his plan on a larger scale and you see purpose. You see planning. You see orderliness. Who are we to criticize God's operations, God's projects, God's purpose or plan? Mr. Armstrong, on the subject of godly character, or how that's instilled within us, he said in Mystery of the Ages, it comes by yielding to God to instill his law, God's right way of life, within the entity who so decides and wills. Actually, this perfect character comes only from God as instilled within the entity of his creation upon voluntary acquiescence, even after severe trial and test. So we have to voluntarily acquiesce. We have to give our consent. We have to say, God, yes, it's your will, not my will. Your will be done. You make me into a God being. You do the fashioning. You do the shaping, the molding. I trust you. You know what's best. Father knows best. It's amazing when you surrender to that master potter, how much you, when you see the fruits of his work in your life, you can actually come to the point where you delight in the will of God. Now that's a miraculous transformation, because there's so much built-in hostility toward God and his law. But through the power of God's Spirit, and by submitting to and yielding to his will, God can actually reproduce his character, nature, his way of thinking, his way of living into our minds and lives. Listen to Psalm 40, verse 7. Verses 7 and 8, it says, then said I, lo, I come, in the volume of the book it is written of me, I delight, verse 8, I delight to do your will, O my God. Yes, your law is within my heart. God is the genius. God is the expert. He's the master. He's the master potter. Our role, our position, is to let him do his work, to let him fulfill his will in our lives. My father writes in How to Be an Overcomer, our will has to be used the way God wants to use it. God works in us, and it is God's will that gets things done, and God's Holy Spirit that accomplishes the job. That's how we keep things in perspective. We're like the artistic product in God's creative hands. Again, Isaiah, Paul in Romans, we just read it. They asked, shall the clay say to him that fashions it, what are you making? Or why are you making me this way? Of course that doesn't happen. Back to How to Be an Overcomer. It says we have to build within our minds the very will of God and the character of God. Then we will do of God's good pleasure. It says we'll do his work. It takes massive effort to do that. But we need to recognize how easy it is not to do it. It's so easy not to fulfill God's will. But as you do it, the more you do it, the more you yield to it, the more you, like King David, can delight to do the will of God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send written comments to td@kpcg.fm. You can also submit audio feedback at the TDRS page on the trumpet.com website. Just look for the big red button. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.